This is Big Talk. Michael Glab here. There has been news coming out of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. In fact, this morning I went for coffee. I went into the coffee house and I was talking about the Kinsey Institute with the barista. The barista said, there's been drama. And indeed there has been. My guest this week is the executive director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, Dr. Justin Garcia. Justin, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here and to be with you.
Last week, the trustees of Indiana University voted to keep the relationship with the Kinsey Institute. The Kinsey Institute, founded in 1947 by Alfred Kinsey, who was an entomologist, and then decided to switch to human sexuality research. Now, he was the head of the institute, the executive director, until 1956. And then come July 1st, 2019, Justin Garcia was named the executive director.
Yep, I did 1 year as interim director, and then in 2019, exactly, and then after that, I was appointed full-time executive director.
And I think we did this. We had our fingers out, and we were counting. You're the eighth executive director in total.
That's right. There are seven directors, and then Dr. Stephanie Sanders, who is still on our faculty, she's our current research director, served as interim director 3 times, so she's has remarkable power to steady the ship in between transitions. Sometimes one time for 2 years, so she's a force and a brilliant scholar. I'm glad she's on our faculty.
The Associated Press has described Alfred Kinsey as having disrupted cultural norms surrounding sex. How did Kinsey do that?
I love it. And I think it's a great reminder as scholars and academics, when our work can be picked up and have an influence in the world around us, about America, looking at American sexual norms and relationships and gender and reproduction. So Kinsey's work actually went back before the founding of the Institute in 1947. And I love this story. I have to share it. In 1938, Dr. Kinsey was asked to team teach IU's marriage course, its sexual hygiene class. It really represents the very best of university life. Students had so many questions that he couldn't answer because he couldn't find the answers in the literature.
And it didn't exist.
It didn't exist. So he said, well, let's do some research. Let's find students have questions. We don't have answers. This is a university. Let's find answers to those questions. So he started conducting interviews, these sexual histories, mostly initially here in Bloomington, asking folks, including folks on campus. And then 2 years in, then President Herman Wells said to Kinsey, you can't do these interviews and teach the class. You have to pick which one you want to do. Do you want to do the studies or do you want to teach? Because you can't have students as your participants. Kinsey chose to pursue this grand endeavor, this from being this very well-known entomologist, as you said. He collected millions of samples of gall wasps. He was a zoologist. Actually, a few summers ago, I had the great honor in the Museum of Natural History in New York City, was where the wasps are held and the galls that they produced. And they brought me in the bag to see all of them. And there's just millions and millions of carefully cataloged samples. And I thought, well, this explains Kinsey. This almost obsessive detail to variation, to diversity of trait.
Right.
He applied that same technique to then looking at the sexual lives of Americans. Early on, there were 18,000 sexual histories done. Dr. Kinsey himself did over 8,000 of those 18,000 histories. They form the basis of the sort of initial what are called the Kinsey reports, sexual behavior of the human male in 1948 and sexual behavior of the human female in 1953.
Real groundbreaking stuff. And by groundbreaking, I mean there was an earthquake following them.
Yeah, and both were instant bestsellers. Interestingly, America had different reactions to the first volume on men, talking about men's sexual lives, their infidelity, their sexual experiences. 5 years later, when the female volume came out, people reacted very differently to data about their wives and sisters and mothers and daughters.
Let me guess. It's okay for men to mess around.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't okay for women.
Yeah, and I think America just had this wake-up call that rates of orgasm were much lower than anyone thought. Rates of infidelity were much higher than people thought.
Among women?
Yes, among women. And sex before marriage, including in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, were higher than people thought. So it was like someone just blew the cover off and really started to take a look, as Kinsey did, this methodical zoologist, take a look at what was really happening in the world around us. And the things people thought were happening in secret in their own lives, well, you know what? Your neighbor was doing the same thing. And your friend and your cousin and your people down the road and two states away were having the same experiences as you were.
The work has gone on. It continues to go on. Lo and behold, about a year ago, in February of 2023, a member of the Indiana House came up with an amendment for the state's two-year budget plan, the actual bill that says where does money go, and the amendment says no to money from the state going to the Kinsey Institute. How did you all react to that?
Oh, gosh. It was what a sucker punch. And especially because for us, it was just coming off the Institute's 75th anniversary celebrations. So we had we unveiled the sculpture of Dr. Kinsey on campus, what are called legacy sculptures on campus. We had a 75th anniversary research symposium, scholars and scientists from around the world sharing late-breaking studies. And we really were in a celebration mode of all the research accomplishments that had happened. So it came after that, in some sense, perhaps the positive attention we were getting in Bloomington and Indiana and around the world upset some. Now, what's interesting is sometimes I'll hear people say that the Institute is controversial or Dr. Kinsey's work was controversial. And I want to push back on that because I don't think it ever has been controversial per se, but it has always been the subject of attack. It has been the subject of misinformation and attack since its very founding, and lurid rumors about Dr. Kinsey himself and the researchers at the Institute back then and continuing to this day. So what we saw was the legislature fell victim to that misinformation and made legislative action based on it.
The bill was introduced by Representative Larissa Sweet, a Republican from Wabash. Ms. Sweet basically said, IU harbors sex offenders. I don't know what the heck that means. Part of her argument was that Kinsey himself had interviewed some people who either had committed child molestation or had thought about it or fantasized, what have you. And basically she said, aha, you're condoning that kind of thing.
It's a very strange interpretation of reality and facts. So what Dr. Kinsey did as a research method in the 1940s was he wanted to capture everyone in a population. So if you're doing 18,000 interviews, that might mean you went to the Elks Club. And if you interviewed one person, they would attempt what was called saturation. They would say, we're now going to get everyone at this Elks Club. They were pockets that they tried to saturate, little subgroups. And they said, if we're going to talk to a subgroup, let's try and get all of them. So they really tried for their method to be, at the time, something close to representative. We know today it wasn't exactly representative for all sorts of reasons, and statisticians and demographers have said it's not the methods we would use today, almost eight decades later, as it should be. Science is iterative, and it changes, and it improves. But Kinsey's idea was that he wanted to get information from everyone and share that information with the world. So there was no cleansing or hiding of the data. So yeah.
A bad guy, so you're not going to be in it.
Exactly. And in fact, they had a lot of data from prisoners, from sex offenders, from sex workers. So part of that was they interviewed a lot of people who had experienced sexual violence. They also interviewed people who perpetrated sexual violence. Huh. And the researchers made the decision at the time that they were going to report everything that they learned from those participants. That included people who were perpetrators of violence, and they reported on the experiences they had. In one case, it was someone who sexually abused children, and he shared those experiences. And the research team said, well, that's now in the data set. This person has told us experiences they have. Our method, our promise as scientists was that we were going to share everything that we learned. So that data was shared. I think today researchers would handle that differently, and there would be more cautions, and there would be more...
No kidding.
There would be, I think, a lot more clarity about... there's also different regulations and laws about when you interview participants who have committed crimes or who are a danger to themselves or others.
Or maybe you have to report it the minute you hear it.
Yeah.
Well, Ms. Sweet's amendment to the budget was passed 53-34, with 7 Republicans joining all the Democrats voting against it. That very same day, the Senate, the Indiana Senate, approved a bill prohibiting healthcare workers from giving gender-affirming care for trans children. Mm-hmm. I guess they said, let's take care of all the sexual and gender stuff in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. Well, there was worry. If state funds are being cut off from the Kinsey Institute, how does the Kinsey Institute survive?
And I remember at the time there were claims that the Institute was practicing gender-affirming care. And just as a point of fact, we're not a clinic. We don't practice care one way or another. And that's part
of... Or advocate.
Or advocate. The Institute has never been an advocacy organization. We are and have always been an unbiased, apolitical source of scientific and scholarly research. We're a research institute through and through. The Institute has 3 wings. There's 10 laboratories and research centers within the Institute. We have an education and outreach program, and we have the library and special collections.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of forms what the Kinsey Institute is today. And this legislation to limit any state funding, it was state appropriation dollars. Here was the bizarre part is the Institute never had state appropriation dollars. So we are on the Indiana University campus, and we benefit enormously from the relationship with IU. For much of the early years of the Institute's history, it was a separate nonprofit at IU. It was because of Dr. Kinsey and Herman Wells, very early on, were worried about outside influence.
Yeah, it was a nonprofit corporation up until 2016, I understand.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And actually, it's an interesting story. So when the Institute was founded in 1947, the original funder was the Rockefeller Foundation. And Dr. Kinsey and President Wells and the Rockefeller Foundation agreed to form this separate nonprofit for 3 very explicit reasons. One was to protect the data and the participants who provided that data. Kinsey was way ahead of his time in thinking about issues of consent and protecting research participants. Even if you look at his writings and his speeches about human sexuality, the importance of honoring people who share stories, of sex being an experience that should be consensual and pleasurable. Ahead of his time in so many ways, as was President Wells, such a defender of academic freedom, as we know. And they felt that the separate nonprofit, those 3 reasons were to protect the data and the participants who provided that data at a time that a government agency could maybe come in and say, let's identify the homosexuals and put them in a mental institution.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. So really protecting the people. The other was to protect the growing collections. At the time, there were about 15,000 items, artifacts, and photography that Dr. Kinsey was in possession of. He had donated those to the then Institute. But to protect those from being sold or seized. And the third reason, which is, I think, brings us again to the present moment, was that if Indiana University or the state of Indiana became too inhospitable for the Institute for Sex Research, that's what it was then called, to continue to operate and thrive, that it could move from Indiana University. So those were the 3 reasons that it was set up initially that way.
So independence, which protected it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now this big amendment comes up and is passed by the state legislature, and someone comes up with the idea to go nonprofit again. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah, so in 2016, the Institute and IU were merged. So the separate nonprofit was merged. The assets, the hundreds of thousands of items in the special collections, currently around 650,000 items, rare artifacts and photography and books and manuscripts and data sets, they were transferred from the Kinsey Institute, which had its own separate independent board of trustees. They were transferred then to Indiana University. So that was what happened in 2016, in part because it was always a messy relationship. Although it was a separate nonprofit, it was always on the Indiana University campus. The faculty were given tenure in IU departments. So it was always a kind of fairly complicated relationship. So the thought in 2016 was, let's clean this up. IU will always defend academic freedom, and IU will always defend the Kinsey Institute, were the words in 2016 that brought people so much comfort in saying, this has been a wonderful relationship for so many years. We can make sure it will continue to be that way.
But as part of Indiana University, that means state officials, state legislators can get their hands on the stuff.
This is exactly the concern. That was the concern in 2016 with the merger. And so there were a lot of protections put in place at that time.
Uh-huh.
So with this, what it means is since then, it's the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. We've been fully integrated. Our faculty span multiple schools, the College of Arts and Science, medicine, nursing, public health, informatics, law. What the Institute does, the big intellectual enterprise, is that you can go up and down the hall and there's neuroscientists and historians and anthropologists and psychologists all bringing their own methods to bear on studying sex and sexuality. Not trying to create a department or a discipline, but saying a truly multidisciplinary endeavor to understand sexuality, to understand ourselves, to understand society, to understand the world around us. So that was the mission, that is still the mission of the Institute. The issue of state appropriation dollars was then what we call indirects, and it's this question of, well, what about the university? If the university receives some of its funding, as many people know, it's a minority of its funding from the state, how could that then be used or not used towards the Institute? So what we heard from the state is, don't use any of those state dollars to support the Institute. It requires a fairly complex accounting solution to address financial flow, of dollar flow, to make sure. Now, we can do that. We have the enormous talent at the university in our accounting and budgeting and controllers' offices to make that happen. But that's an exercise we've been pursuing. This was not a benign legislation. It concerned our constituents, our faculty, our students, and it's required enormous effort to track funds. And it's required increased fundraising to support the work of the Institute.
Was it anybody's interpretation that the state could say, we give Indiana University X amount of dollars a year or every 2 years, whatever the time period is, and X amount of that goes to the Kinsey Institute. So therefore, next time we allocate money, we're going to cut off the Kinsey X from the IU X. Or does IU get that whole amount and just make sure you don't spend it on Kinsey?
Yeah, that didn't happen to us, in part because there were no state dollars, right? So there were no direct state appropriations that were being used for the Institute. There was no ledger that showed money going to the Institute. The Kinsey Institute is primarily funded through grants and research grants, contracts, and philanthropy, a mixture of endowments and cash that our generous donors provide to maintain our work. And then there's a base budget from the university. But that wasn't what state appropriation dollars are used for, very specific areas of the university. Now, what you just suggested, though, is interesting because that is what the state did to the LGBTQ Culture Center many, many years ago. They asked the university to reduce their appropriations by $50,000 and say, we don't want to fund an LGBTQ Culture Center. So there's been a history of attack on issues of sexuality and gender and women's health and women's issues. They've become politicized. And for us, what's so challenging about that is, as you said, we're not an advocacy center. We do have consultative status to the United Nations. It's mostly ever been used for issues of sexual violence, gender-based violence in particular. So these questions of how, you know, are dollars being used to promote particular ideologies, in fact, they're not. In fact, the Kinsey Institute is a model of how you support asking questions that can inform. In many ways, what's unfortunate is if the legislature has, if any legislature has questions about whether it's gender-affirming care or LGBTQ issues or women's health, research is where we should go, science and published studies to inform those decisions. And what I find so curious about the national debates happening right now in America about things like gender care and trans rights and LGBTQ issues and abortion and women's health, almost all of those conversations have been absent of the remarkable scientific data that we have that could guide legislation that is based on research, on facts. It's not to say people shouldn't have opinions. They absolutely should. They should interpret those facts. But why are we not leaning on that science, the stuff that the Kinsey Institute is world-renowned for doing?
The eternal question. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Once this amendment and the cutoff of funding became known, it caused a worldwide cause célèbre.
That's right.
A lot of people came and said, hey, what's going to happen? University, what are you going to do about it? In November, IU President Pamela Whitten and Provost Rahul Srivastav said they stand firmly in support of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. And then the trustees voted just last week, Friday, March 1st, 2024. And what did they come to?
Yes. Yeah, so we've had enormous support from IU leadership who have really risen to the moment to reaffirm what is the sacred principle of higher education. That's academic freedom, the right to ask bold questions. So along the way, over the last year, there was this question of could one solution be making the Institute a separate entity? And that was faced by enormous pushback from the Kinsey Institute faculty, the staff, the students, from scholars around the world, from legal analysts outside the university.
And other schools within the university,
oh,
sure.
Yes, and because people were so concerned. Now, the part of that is that this is a complex political matter for the university to manage. And a financial manner. And what has been important, I think, for all of us and for me to remember is that at no point were we told we're going to set the Institute out to sea on its own, right? The university has always maintained support. But what would that support look like? And what are the best decisions to make? Those were the debates over the last few months. And they were intense debates about the best decisions. A special working group was put together by the Provost Srivastav that produced four, I think, very tight and cogent recommendations, including to delay this idea of a separation. That report's now public. And as you said, media from around the world were paying attention. It also highlights for all of us that here in Bloomington, Indiana, the Sex Institute is world-renowned. It is the leading sexological research institute in the world. And we have some of the best scientists working on different issues of aging and sexuality, of fertility. My own work is on romantic and sexual relationships. We also, over the last few years, we've really built up our work on sexual violence, which makes some of these defamatory and outrageous claims that have been lobbed against us in this misinformation campaign particularly bizarre when you think this is a place we are doing cutting-edge work on sexual violence, on understanding it and stopping rape in Indiana and around the world. But this last year, looking at ways to respond to the legislation, this proposal of separating was met with so much pushback by all of our constituents locally and globally. So thankfully, on Friday, last Friday, the IU trustees, with the support of IU leadership, with the recommendation of the IU president, decided not to pursue a separate entity, but to pursue an accounting solution to make sure. I mean, we do have an obligation to make sure we are compliant with this law. We all take that seriously. But we are working on a solution. We have the blueprint for a solution that allows us to do that without separating the Institute and without weakening academic freedom.
Our guest this week, Dr. Justin Garcia, the executive director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. Justin, how did you get into this business?
It's a great question. So many of my colleagues have really great stories. I have to refine mine. I don't have a great story. I was in my training. I did my master's in anthropology and biomedical anthropology, and then I did my PhD in evolutionary biology. So trained very similarly to Dr. Kinsey, and then I first came to Bloomington as a postdoc for then Director Julia Hyman, who is a clinical psychologist, and really learned new methods. And I had with her mentorship and with the mentorship of all the faculty at the Institute. That's always been the model that you can run up and down the hall and have scholars and scientists who all help nurture the next generation of scientists and scholars. And I was really fortunate to be able to stay and join the faculty after that. But my own questions early on as a biologist, my dissertation was on the evolution of monogamy. So when it comes to all the things that people think happen at the Institute, I'm pretty vanilla. I was studying studying monogamy in humans and when it evolved, and sort of about 4 million years ago, we saw the evolution between 4 and 4.4 million years ago, the evolution of social monogamy in our ancestors. That's informing intense pair bonds. Only about 3% of mammals do that. 15% of primates. So it's fairly unique that we form these intense bonds, what we would call love bonds. So I was asking questions about that, and then variation, infidelity, sexual hookup culture, people who were consensually non-monogamous. So my core was monogamy, and then I looked at different types and variation in different places and times. So that was my background, but I was really approaching the questions from a biological perspective, thinking about genes that were involved in risk-taking and sexual activity, about monogamy and pair bonds. And then when I came to the Institute, my lens widened, and that's the beauty of higher education and scholarship and being at a place like this. I was surrounded by these brilliant colleagues using different methods, and I started to see more opportunity for research questions, more nuance than I had before. It's really this widening of the lens that can happen when we're surrounded by great people who have the courage to ask brave questions.
Okay, now you're the executive director. That means you're the boss of the operation. Do you get to do research?
I try. I try to keep my research program going. I'm very fortunate. I run my lab with Dr. Amanda Gesselman, who's a social developmental psychologist. We've been longtime research partners for over a decade now. That has been, Amanda's been my saving grace in being able to stay research active. I do try. Over the last year in particular, I felt a little bit more like a strategist. And then dealing with some sort of politics and fundraising to make sure that everyone at the Institute has the resources to continue their work unencumbered. So a lot more of my time today is focused on fundraising, strategy, supporting the different aspects of the Institute. But I do try and stay research active. For the last 13 years, I've been scientific advisor to Match.com. And we do a very large project with them every year called Singles in America. We just released our newest findings. We look at every year a new sample of 5,000 U.S. singles and their dating aptitudes and behaviors. So we're continuing that legacy of asking bold questions to people around the country about their intimate lives.
It's been a little touch and go for about a year with Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. Just the other day, the IU Board of Trustees voted not to spin Kinsey off into an independent nonprofit. The IU big shots are standing four square behind Kinsey, despite this new legislation that cuts off state funding for the Institute. Our guest this week has been Dr. Justin Garcia. He's the executive director of the Kinsey Institute. Thanks for being on Big Talk.
Thanks for having me.